Okay, well, here we go. You know what I'm going to say, so let's go ahead and do it. Turn with me, if you will, to the place where this week's Torah portion begins. It's the book of Numbers, or Bamidbar, in the wilderness, chapter 16, right at the beginning. And the first usable, different, unique word in here is Korach. So it says, this fellow took men Korach, son of Ishar, son of Kohath, son of Levi, along with Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben. Well, they all took men. They rose up in the face of Moshe, with certain of the children of Israel, some 250 men, princes of the congregation, the elect men of the assembly. It says men of renown in the English. Now, it turns out in the Hebrew, it's actually men of Shem, men with name. In other words, their names were well known. They had name recognition. And what did they do? They assembled themselves together against Moshe and against Aaron, and they said to them, "Y'all take too much upon you, seeing all kol adat, all of the congregation are set apart holy, every one of them." Does this sound like something we've heard recently? Unless you're a extremist, white supremacist, homophobe, why, you're all holy. Yeah. And Yahuwah is among them. So therefore, why do you lift up yourselves above the kahal of Yahuwah? So Moshe heard it. He fell on his face. He spoke to Korah and to all of his company, and he said, "Look, in the morning Yahuwah will show you just who are his, who is holy, and who he will cause to come near unto him, even him whom he may choose. He will cause to come near unto him." In other words, he'll settle this. We'll find out in the morning. So here's what you're going to do. He says, "You take your censers, Korah, and all of his company, go put fire in them, put incense upon them before Yahuwah tomorrow morning, and it will be that the man whom Yahuwah has chosen, that when he chooses, he will be kadosh, set apart. You, instead," he says, he's turning back around on them what they said, "you take too much upon you sons of Levi." So Moshe then said to Korah, "Hear now, you sons of Levi," or Levi, "Really, is it a small thing unto you that the Elohim of Israel has separated you from out of the Edot of congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself, to do the service of the Mishkan of Yahuwah? I mean, that's not a small deal, is it? You'd think that that would be enough, that you'd be pretty happy about that." And he's bringing you near to himself to do the service of the Mishkan of Yahuwah, to stand before the congregation to minister unto them. And that he has brought you near, you and all your sons, your brethren, the sons of Levi with you. And yet now you want to be Kohanim too. You seek the priesthood also. So therefore, you and with all your company that are gathered together against Yahuwah. And as to Aaron, who's he? What is he that you murmur against him? So at this point, Moshe sent to call Dathan and Abiram, sons of Eliab. They said, "And we're not coming up. You can call all you want. We're not coming. Is it a small thing that you have brought us?" Now listen to this and ask yourself the question. I every time I read this and I think about this rebellion, I notice that there are certain things evidently that are common to this kind of attitude throughout human history. They take what they're doing and what is being done for them, and they turn it upside down, and they accuse whoever it is that they're against of doing it or of failing to do that which they, in fact, don't intend to do. It's really kind of interesting. So, is it a small thing, they say, that you have brought us out of a land flowing with milk and honey? Now, where'd they come out of? Egypt. Yeah, bondage. To kill us here in this wilderness, but you must needs make yourself also a prince over us. Moreover, you haven't brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey, nor given us the inheritance of fields and vineyards. Will you pull out the eyes of these men? In other words, you're going to keep pulling the wool over their eyes. It's a colloquial expression. We won't come up. So Moshe, he was pretty well PO'd, says. He was very wroth. He said unto Yahuwah, "Don't respect their offering, I pray you. Please don't," he says. "I have not taken one ass from them, nor have I hurt one of them." In other words, there's nothing that they have on me. Moshe then said to Korah, "By you, be thou and all your congregation before Yahuwah. You do what you've said you're going to do. You and they, and before Aaron and Yahuwah tomorrow. and you get yourself every man. You take his fire pan, put incense upon him, and bring yourself before Yahuwah, every man his fire pan, 250 of them in total. You also, and Aaron too, he'll bring his fire pan. So, every man, they took his fire pan, they put fire in him, they laid some incense on him, they stood there at the door of the tent of meeting with Moshe and with Aaron. Now, this is going to turn out to be one of those things where you say, a Darwin Award winners, last thing they're going to do, not exactly a good plan in hindsight. Korah assembled Kol of the congregation, all of the Kahal, against them at the door of the tent of meeting, and the glory of Yahuwah appeared to Kol Ha'edah, all of them, all of the congregation. And Yahuwah spoke to Moshe and to Aaron. Notice whom he's addressing. And he says, you know what? You better separate yourselves. Put a little distance here between you and this congregation, this Kol Ha'edah, this assembly, that I might just consume them here in a moment. And they fell upon their faces, and they said, O Elohim, Elohim of spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin, and you be wroth with everybody, the whole mess of them, all the congregation? In other words, sounds like they think he's going to just whack them all. Maybe so. Yahuwah then spoke to Moshe, and he said, speak unto the congregation, and tell them the following, to the Adah. So, the congregation, the whole fellowship, speak, you tell them the following. Get up from about the dwellings of Korah and Dathan and Abiram. The dwelling. Same word here that's used for Mishkan. You separate yourselves from their Mishkan. So Moshe rose up, and he went to Dathan and Abiram, and the elders of Israel followed after him, and he said to the congregation, y'all get out of here, depart, I pray you, from the tents of these wicked men. Don't touch anything of theirs, lest you be swept away in all of their sins. So there's a camp within a camp, and again, the message, right, just like we see in Revelation, come out of her, be separate, put some distance here. So they got themselves up from the dwelling of Korah, Dathan, Abiram, on every side. Meanwhile, Dathan and Abiram came out. They stood at the door of their tents with their wives and their sons and their little ones. So their families were all there. Moshe said, hereby, this is how you shall know that Yahuwah has sent me to do all these works, and that I have not done them out of my own lev, my own heart. Or sometimes it's rendered as mine, but it's my own heart, he says here. If these men now die, the common death of all men, and be visited after the visitation of all men, then you'll know that Yahuwah hasn't sent me. In other words, if nothing happens, if they just live regular lives and they die at their appointed times, well, you know, no big deal, but you will know that Yahuwah has not sent me. On the other hand, here's the important element, but if Yahuwah does a new thing, something we haven't seen before, and the ground literally opens up her mouth, that word here is Ha-Adamah, the same place that Adam came from. If the ground, Ha-Adamah, opens up her mouth and just plain swallows them up, and they and everything that pertains to them, and they all go down alive, literally into the pit, then you shall understand that these men have in fact despised. Now the word there, by the way, is Sheol, the pit or death. They go on down there alive. Then you'll understand that these men have provoked. There's an interesting word here in the Hebrew. It's na'atsu, despised even. Not Moshe, but despised Yahuwah is how he puts it. Elohim. And it came to pass, as he made an end of speaking these words, in other words, the words just out of his mouth, the ground in fact did cleave asunder that was under them. And the earth, ha'aretz, opened up her mouth and swallowed them up, their households, all the men that appertained unto Korah, and everything they had, all their goods, their tents, all their stuff, you name it, down it went. So they, and all that appertained to them, went down alive into the pit, and the earth closed over upon them, and they perished from among the Kahal, the assembly. And all Israel that was around about them fled at the cry. This must have been kind of a horrifying thing to watch. They said, oh, lest the earth swallow us up too. Well, you know, maybe that's why he told you to move away from them. Think about it. Fire then came forth from Yahuwah and devoured the 250 men that offered incense. And if you're thinking about the strange fire, I guess maybe there is a parallel here. Next chapter says, Yahuwah spoke unto Moshe, and he said, okay, tell, speak unto Eleazar, son of Aaron the priest, tell him to take up the fire pans out of that burning. So go get the fire pans from that the folks that are now ashes there, and you scatter the fire out yonder, because these fire pans have now become set apart. They're holy. So even the fire pans of these men who have sinned at the cost of their own lives, let them be made beaten plates for a covering of the altar. So we're going to use this, make something out of them, because they have become holy, because they were offered before Yahuwah, that this might be a sign unto the B'nai Yisrael. So Eleazar the Kohen, he took the brazen fire pans, which they had, those who were now burnt alive were offered, had offered, and they beat them out into a covering for the altar, to be a memorial unto the B'nai Israel, to the end that no common man, no one who is not of the seed of Aaron, would draw near to burn incense before Yahuwah, that he fare not as Korah did and his company, as Yahuwah spoke unto him by the hand of Moshe. And Rashi's take is kind of interesting. He says what that means is so that he would not be as Korah. In other words, he would not purpose to do what Korah did. But on the morrow, all of the congregation, Kol Adot, of the B'nai Israel, everybody that murmured against Moshe and against Aaron, on the morrow, they did this. They basically, another whine. This is a different kind of a whine. All of the children murmured, whined against Moshe and against Aaron. And what did they say? You bad people, you killed the people of the Lord of Yahuwah. Came to pass when the congregation was assembled against Moshe and against Aaron, that they looked towards the tent of meeting. Behold, the cloud covered it, and the glory of Yahuwah appeared. So Moshe and Aaron came to the front of the tent of meeting, and Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, and he said, you can kind of guess how this is going to pan out, right? Pan out intended, pun intended. Lift yourselves up. Get yourself up from among this congregation, this Adah. Separate yourself, so that I may consume them in a moment. You notice there's a kind of a continuing theme here, isn't there? They keep asking for it, and eventually I'm going to do it. That I may consume them. Well, they fell upon their faces. Now, this time Moshe said to Aaron, get your fire pan, put fire in it, off the altar, lay incense on it, and move, buddy, get yourself going, carry it out quickly into the congregation, and make atonement for them. For the wrath has gone out from Yahuwah, the plague has already begun. Now, I got to imagine, this is a pretty amazing scene. The words here imply he is really getting a move on. Remember, Aaron at this point is in his early to mid-80s. And he is booking. So he heads out. Aaron took as Moshe spoke. He ran into the midst of the assembly. Behold, the plague had already begun among the people. He put on the incense, and he made atonement for the people. And he literally ran and stood between the dead and the living. And the plague was stayed. I like the term here, cauterized. It's almost like he moved. He got in between, interposed himself, and cut it off. Because it was spreading throughout. You can imagine they were just dropping like flies. They that died by the plague in the seconds, who knows how long, seconds, minutes, how long did it take him to do this? They that died by the plague were 14,700. Those are almost Fauci kind of numbers, folks. Think about this. Besides them that had already died in the matter concerning Korah. So there are a whole lot of dead folks here as a result of the rebellion that essentially began with Korah and continued to spread. So then Aaron returned unto Moshe to the door of the tent of meeting, and the plague was stayed. This time it says, Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, and he said, speak unto the B'nai Israel, and take for them, or of them, take rods, one rod for each of his father's house. So we're going to have 12 tribes, 12 rods, all of them princes according to their father's houses, 12 rods, and you write upon each man's rod, put his name on it. So they got the rods, they put the names on them. You shall write Aaron's name upon the rod for the house of Levi, for there'll be one rod for the head of each of their father's houses. Now you'll lay them up in the tent of meeting before the testimony where I meet with you. So literally on the inside here. And it'll come to pass that the man whom I shall choose, his rod will bud. And I will make cease from me these murmurings, these whinings of the B'nai Israel, which they continue to murmur against you. And Moshe spoke unto the Bnei Israel, and all the princes gave him rods, one for each prince, according to their father's houses, total of 12 rods, and the rod of Aaron was among those rods. Moshe then laid up the rods before Yahuwah in the tent of the testimony, the Ohel of Ha-Adat. And it came to pass on the morrow that Moshe went into the tent of the testimony, and behold, the rod of Aaron for the house of Levi had budded. It put forth buds and had bloomed blossoms and even bore ripe almonds. So Moshe brought out all the rods from before Yahuwah to the Bnei Israel, and they looked, and every man took his own rod. And Yahuwah said unto Moshe, put back that rod of Aaron before the testimony to be kept there for a token against the rebellious children, a sign that there may be an end of their murmurings against me. Oh yeah, and that they die not. This sounds like another one of these prescient warnings. So thus did Moshe, as Yahuwah commanded him, so he did. The children of Israel spoke to Moshe, and they said, behold, we perish, we're undone, we are all undone. Hey, maybe they're starting to get it. Everyone that comes near, anyone that comes near the tabernacle, the Mishkan of Yahuwah, is to die. Shall we wholly perish? So I guess par for the course. Now they are, now they're flipping and going off the deep end in the other direction. So chapter 18 is going to basically be Yahuwah saying, here's how we're going to deal with this particular malady of a lack of faith or a fear or whatever the case may be when it runs amok. Yahuwah said to Aaron, you and your sons and your father's house with you shall bear the iniquity, the Torahlessness of the sanctuary, of the Mishkan. And you and your sons with you shall bear the iniquity of the priesthood for all the Kohanim. Your brethren also, the tribe of Levi, the tribe of your father, you bring them near with you, that they may be joined unto you and minister unto you, you and your sons with you, being before the tent, the Ohel of the testimony. And they shall keep the charge. So in other words, we're going to separate these folks going to do this job, not the laity. And they'll have charge of all of the Ohel of the tent. Only they will not come nigh unto the holy furniture and unto the altar, that they die not, neither they nor you. So there are going to be some rules here. Here's how we're going to set this up. They shall be joined unto you and keep the charge of the tent of meeting, whosoever or whatsoever the service of that tent may be. But a common man, he will not come near. And you shall keep the charge of the set-apart things, the kadosh things, and the charge of the altar. And that way there will be no more wrath upon the Bnei Yisrael. Behold, I have taken your brethren, the Levites, from among the Bnei Israel, for you they are given as a gift unto Yahuwah. Remember, the firstborn, we had that swap and the exchange and the slight differences there, but now the Levites have taken that position. They are a gift unto Yahuwah to do the service of the tent of meeting. Now you and your sons with you shall keep the Kohanimship, the priesthood, in everything that pertains to the altar, and to do that which is within the veil. There's where you shall serve. I give you the priesthood as a service of gift, and the common man that draws nigh, he shall be put to death. And Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, or spoke unto Aaron, it says, and behold, to you have I given charge of my heave offerings, even of all the hallowed things of the Bnei Israel. Unto you have I given them for a consecrated portion, and to your sons this will be a due forever. So this is your line and your lineage and your blessing, these offerings. This shall be thine, yours, of the most holy things reserved from the fire. Every offering of theirs, every meal offering of theirs, every sin offering of theirs, chatat, every guilt offering of theirs, which they may render under me, shall be most holy, most set apart to you and for you and your sons. In a most holy place you shall eat of it. Every male may eat of it. It shall be holy unto you. And this is yours, the heave offering of their gift, even all the wave offerings of the Bnei Israel. I have given those to you and your sons and your daughters with you as a due forever. Everyone that is clean in your house may eat thereof. All the best of the oil, all the best of the wine, all the best of the corn, the first part of them which they give unto Yahuwah, to you have I given them. So they give them to me, and in turn I'm giving them to you. The first ripe fruits of all that's in their land, which they bring unto you, that shall be yours. Everyone that is clean in your house may eat of that. Everything devoted in Israel, this is that word, cherem. Everything that is devoted to him, in other words, shall be yours. Everything that opens the womb of all flesh, which they offer unto Yahuwah, both of man and beast, shall be yours. Howbeit, the firstborn of man you shall surely redeem. The firstling of unclean beasts you shall redeem. And that redemption money, from a month old you shall redeem them, shall be, according to your valuation, the following. 5 shekels of silver, the shekel of the sanctuary, 20 gerahs. But the firstling of an ox, or of a sheep, or of a goat, you shall not redeem. They are set apart. You dash their blood against the altar, and make their fat smoke for an offering made by fire, a sweet savor unto Yahuwah. The flesh of them shall be yours, though, as a wave breast, as the right thigh, that shall be yours. All the heave offerings of the holy things which the B'nai Israel offer unto Yahuwah, I have given them to you, and your sons and your daughters with you, as a due forever. It shall be an everlasting covenant of salt before Yahuwah unto you and unto your seed with you. And then Yahuwah said unto Aaron, you shall have no inheritance in their land. So there are, I guess you could say, good news and bad news, or at least there are strictures associated with this idea of the Levites, and especially the Kohanim, the sons of Aaron in that line. They shall have no inheritance in the land, neither shall you have any portion among them. I am your portion and your inheritance among the B'nai Israel. And unto the children of Levi, behold, I have given all the tithe in Israel for an inheritance, in return for their service which they serve, even the service of the tent of meeting, of the Mishkan, the Ohel. Therefore, henceforth the B'nai Israel shall not come nigh the tent of meeting, lest they bear sin and die. So essentially, all of this is saying, this is your portion, you are being set apart, these things are yours as a result, and you are going to be the ones that are going to bear the iniquity of the Torah-lessness of the congregation. On the other hand, they are not going to come nigh, not come anywhere close to the tent of meeting, lest they bear that sin and die. This is how we're going to separate this situation. The Levites alone shall do the service of the tent of meeting. They shall bear their iniquity. This shall be a statute forever, ha'olam, throughout your generations, and among the B'nai Israel, they shall have no inheritance. Because the tithe of the children of Israel, which they set apart as a gift unto Yahuwah, I have given to the Levites for an inheritance. And therefore I have said to them, among the children of Israel, they have no inheritance. All right, we're coming to the conclusion here, and at this point Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, and he said, moreover, you shall speak unto the Levites and say the following to them. When you take of the B'nai Israel the tithe, which I have given you from them for your inheritance, then you shall set apart of it a gift for Yahuwah, even a tenth of the tithe, a tithe out of the tithe. Okay, so you get all of it, and you give a tenth back. The gift which you set apart shall be reckoned unto you as though it were the corn of the threshing floor and as the fullness of the winepress. Thus you shall also set apart a gift unto Yahuwah of all your tithes which you receive of the B'nai Israel, and therefore you shall give the gift which is set apart unto Yahuwah, specifically to Aaron the priest. Out of all that's given you, you shall set apart all of that which is due unto Yahuwah, all of the best, the hallowed part, out of it. So therefore you shall say unto them, when you set apart the best thereof from it, it shall be counted unto the Levites as the increase of the threshing floor, as the increase of the winepress. And you may eat it in every place, you and your household, for it is your reward in return for your service in the Ohel, the tent of meeting. And you shall bear no sin by reason of it, seeing that you have set apart from it the best. And you shall not profane the set apart things of the B'nai Israel, that they die not. And with that, the Torah portion ends, and so does the story of probably one of the most famous rebellions in all human history. And I guess I'll say it again. What strikes me every time I read through this is how, there's a French saying, the more things change, the more they stay the same. It's kind of based on Solomon's observation that there's nothing new under the sun. What has been is what shall be. And ultimately, that's what we're seeing. The rebellions, as we look at them and we recognize some of the things they say, some of the things they do, there are certainly consistencies there.
So come out of her, oh my people,
has come to judge Babylon. So come out of her.
Hey folks, Boker Tov, Shabbat Shalom, and welcome back. We're going to talk today about the parsha that is called Korach. And it, of course, is named for probably the most famous rebellion in the Bible. And it starts with Korah, the son of Itchar, son of Kohath, son of Levi. So he is one of the major groups or families within the tribe of Levi, along with a couple other fellows, Dathan and Abiram, sons of Reuben, ultimately. They all took men. They rose up in the face of Moshe with others of the B'nai Israel, some 250 men, princes of the congregation, men of name. They had, well-known names among the assembly. And they got together and they said unto themselves, unto Moshe and Aaron, you take too much upon you. And here's the point where I want to start. I'm going to make a couple of points today to kind of set this up, because what I really want to talk about is this idea of rebellion. Certainly, we're looking at a situation where we recall that in this nation's history, in the United States history, there was what was called a rebellion at one point. A lot of people said, no, it's the king that, in fact, has rebelled against the creator of the universe, and he has done all these things that mark him as a tyrant. They issued that declaration as a result. We're coming up on the time when a good 5% or so of the American public will remember and commemorate that event. Most hate everything that it stands for. They especially hate, I think, the idea that there were certain self-evident truths that are no longer taught in the cesspools, and that tells us where we are. And it also tells us why this is such an important element, understanding. Because, you know, is it rebellion to rebel against a tyrant or not? Especially if a tyrant is allegedly, at least, as King George and the divine right of kings and all those who worship at that altar claim. If they're supposed to be God's emissaries, his anointed people, men on earth, and so forth. And I think it's therefore important to kind of start out by looking at Korach, look at the parallels here, where we are in the situation. And I'm going to ask a question. Now, I think as we go through this, we're going to find that it's not a simple answer. But what is the opposite of Moshe? What is the opposite of Moshe? We remember Moshe was arguably, he was a man who literally talked with Yah. He heard, he did his work, he was hand-selected, if you will. Among those that hold to a rabbinic Jewish tradition, Moshe is considered to be kind of like the greatest guy that ever lived. He certainly is one of them. As a matter of fact, for those that say no, the one that superseded him is the one that's called a prophet like unto Moshe, the Mashiach, the son of Yah, the Torah made flesh himself. But it's still interesting that there are some characteristics that we can look at and talk about. And a lot of them will apply one way or the other to Korach, and in some cases they will be opposites, but not polar opposites like arguably we're seeing today. And that's part of the reason why I want to kind of explore this. Because ultimately, well, let's start with the way the Torah portion starts. These men assemble themselves against Moshe and against Aaron. So right there we got a problem. They are facing off against the appointed and anointed people of Yod-Heh Vav-Heh. And they said the following to them, y'all take too much upon yourselves, because the whole congregation is holy, every one of them. Why do you lift yourselves up above them? And I look at that, I read that, and I think, you know, isn't that just exactly what we're seeing today? All the congregation are holy. We are the ones who are inclusive. We are the ones who are tolerant. We are the ones who are not judgmental. You guys are being judgmental and not inclusive and intolerant and probably homophobic and every other kind of phobic we can make up. Do we see that there are, in fact, a few things that literally don't change when it comes to rebellions? I guess that's part of it. Here's another element of the things about rebellion that seem kind of timeless. Moshe, he then calls on Dathan and Abiram. We're not going to come up. We don't want to talk to you. And then they ask this question. I guess they had to have asked through an intermediary. Is it a small thing that you brought us out of a land flowing with milk and honey? Now, wait a second. They were brought out of bondage. Isn't that just like what we see with the tyrants today? What we have, what we offer you, is the real milk and honey stuff. Our bondage, our tyranny. You'll have nothing. You'll eat bugs and you'll like it. you brought us out of a land of milk and honey, here to kill us in the wilderness. And more of you haven't brought us into the land you said you would. No, we're not going to come up, and so forth. So ultimately, there are several things like this that we look at and we go, wow, there seem to be timeless elements. Matter of fact, Scripture says there come a time, and I think we're there, where you will see men calling evil good and good evil. And we have come so far down that road that we now got cesspools. I don't even like to call them public schools. These are cesspools, indoctrination centers, teaching little boys and little girls that you can't, well, there is no God, but if there was, he can't tell an innie from an outie. He doesn't know what he made you. Male and female, he created them. No. Your gender is fluid, and we may just screw with it. I think that's an appropriate way. We will groom you into something different than he made. How's that for calling evil good and good evil? Yeah, little girls, cut off your breasts. We'll destroy your ovaries. You'll never have kids. Ha ha. We're not going to tell you that until you're old enough to figure it out. But we'll get you while you're prepubescent. We may inject you with some drugs so that you never even get there. And once we're done with you, you'll never have anything in the way of sex life or procreation, calling good evil and evil good. One of the things that I think is characteristic, we see it throughout this portion and in some of the things that the rebels said, is this concept of, that I guess I would call misappropriation. In other words, not only do they turn things upside down, calling evil good and good evil, they will accuse the good guys of doing the things that they're doing. This was a classic Hitlerian technique, right? You basically break the law. You accuse your opponent of being lawless. You say, I'm above the law. I can destroy documents. I'll have the FBI help me, and we'll bleach bit some disk drives, and I'll commit treason, and I'll put these things up on a public server. And anyway, if somebody catches me, I'll just say that's what you're doing. And you're the one who fails to recognize that nobody is above the law. So we will throw you in jail with our lawfare and so forth. So there's that aspect of misappropriation. The other one's probably even more obvious. You take a symbol, something that the creator of the universe selected to say, maybe as a sign that I will never again destroy the world with water, say a rainbow. And you misappropriate that and you turn it into something else that is literally an abomination before him, kind of like rubbing his nose in it and saying, I'll take the symbol that you made as a sign of a covenant between Yah and man, and I'll turn it into something which you don't like and have called an abomination and said carries a death penalty. Ha ha, how's that for rubbing your nose in it? So misappropriation is certainly another technique that seems to become kind of timeless nowadays. All right, well, let's pursue just a bit more of the story, because I think the story and what happens sets up so much of the elements of what we want to look at today. Right off the bat, when they get ready to say, okay, here's the test. We're all gonna line up. You guys bring your censers down, put fire in your fire pans, and here's what's gonna happen, and so forth. Moses was wroth. He says to Yahuwah, don't respect their offering. I haven't taken anything from them. And then he says to Korah, okay, y'all get down on here tomorrow. We'll see what's gonna happen here. Every man's gonna take his fire pan, put incense upon him, bring him before Yahuwah. 250 fire pans. You also, Aaron will be there. He'll have his fire pan. So they did that. Now, let's pause at this point. There's an interesting anti... It's not a complete antithesis in the case of Korah, because if you look at the modern rebels, those who are truly antithetical to Yod Heh Vav Heh, adversarial, if you will, they clearly serve another god, a god that is antithetical. Well, Korah here, he may be self-serving. He may think he should be the head honcho, and that seems to be his primary problem. You could say hubris, maybe. But at least he claims to be serving the God of the Bible. And he and his guys are going to get there. They're going to get their fire pan. They seem to acknowledge the authority of Moshe to set up the test, which is kind of interesting. And ultimately, they claim that what they're going to do is they're going to serve God. Whether they know his name or not, we're not told. I assume they do, because unlike the modern-day priests of another god, they seem to understand who they're referring to, because even though the words are removed in the English renderings, sounds like when Moshe talks about Yod Heh Vav Heh, they understand that and they know what they're going to do. So they stood at the door of the tent of meeting with Moshe and Aaron. Korah got all of his guys together against them at the door, and uh, the glory of Yahuwah appeared there unto Kol, Ha-Edah, all of the congregation. Now, at this point, Yahuwah speaks. This is always entertaining, right? Who does he speak to? He speaks to Moses and Aaron. He doesn't speak to those guys, the ones that claim to be his emissaries. He speaks to Moses and Aaron, and he says, you know, you better separate yourself. Put a little distance between you and them, because I'm going to consume them in a moment. I guess here comes another mark of leadership and another mark of not the kind of thing you want to follow. They fell upon their faces. I think they in this case means Moshe and Aaron. And they said, O Elohim, the God of all the spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin? One man, in this case, Korah, but there's 250 guys with him. And will you, in fact, really take it out on the whole congregation? Kol Ha-Edah? Shall one guy sin and everybody get punished for it? So, Yahuwah spoke to Moses in particular, and he says, you now speak to Ha'edah, speak to the congregation, and say the following to them. Y'all separate yourselves. Get up, separate yourself from the dwellings of Korah and Dathan and Abiram. And literally, the dwelling in this case is the word Mishkan, which I've always thought was interesting and very much ironic. Because this dwelling that is the place where Yah comes to stay with them has the same name. But the one that Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, each of them have, is fixing to head down, literally, as well as figuratively. So Moshe went up. He went to Dathan and Abiram. The elders of Israel followed him. And he spoke to the congregation, Ha'edah, and he said, hey, you know, y'all, depart, I pray you, from the tents of these wicked men. Don't even touch any of their stuff, lest you be swept away in all their sins. So, the good news, I guess, is the people listened. They got up from around the dwellings of Korah and Dathan and Abiram on every side. Those guys came out. They stood with their little ones, their wives, their sons, and their families at the door of their tents. And Moshe issues the famous, I guess you'd say, deadly proclamation here. And how by this you shall know that Yahuwah has sent me to do all these works, and I didn't do them of my own heart. I didn't make this stuff up. And if these men die the common deaths of all men, yeah, nothing happens here. Okay, I'm wrong, and Yahuwah hasn't sent me. He is literally going out on a limb. I think about the confidence, I guess, that it takes to stand here and say, I am going to call, literally, on the God of all creation to say who is his and who is not. If anything doesn't happen here, then it ain't me. But if Yahuwah does create, he makes a new thing, and the ground opens up her mouth and swallows them up, and everything that goes along with them, everything of theirs, and they go down alive, literally, to Sheol, the pit, then you shall know that these men have despised Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Now, that, too, is another one of those things as I look at this and I point out the parallels and what do we see about rebellion and modern so-called leaders that aren't. And you know, where are we in the opposite half cycle? Is it time, for example, for people to say, oh, Korah rebelled against the leadership of Moshe and he suffered for it? So therefore you can't rebel against the leadership of, say, a Pol Pot, an Idi Amin, an Adolf Hitler, or a Joseph R. Biden and his crackhead son? Doesn't matter if the law is not the same and they're above the... Is there a parallel here? Is there an anti-parallel? Is this an opposite half cycle? Here's the question. Is it not obvious that we're not even serving the same, and I'll say this very advisedly, we're not even serving the same damned God? Those guys, those who put their hand on a Bible, in some cases there's question that they even did, and swore an oath and then violated up one end and down the other. There's no doubt about it, folks. You can't watch what's going on in America today and tell me that you even remotely believe that anybody, I mean anybody, serving this titanic, and I use that term, I guess, with a pun intended, evil regime, doesn't know that they are serving something truly satanic. There's no way. There's no way they can even pretend that they're serving the God of the Bible, honestly. They're taking little kids. They deserve the millstone that they know full well if they've ever read his book, which I doubt many of them have. Some of them do it just to hate what he says. They don't know what they deserve. Again, there comes a point, and this is, I guess, part of what I am suggesting, where the anti-parallels, the opposites, they're so polar and so clear that it's literally impossible to deny what we're up against, what we're facing, and who is serving whom, which is what makes this story with Korah so interesting. Because, in fact, Korah claims to be serving, I think if you ask him, and he made the point, he would be serving the one true God. They certainly went to their deaths thinking that was the case. Matter of fact, we're going to get an interesting symbol, memorial here, in just a couple of seconds to make that point. So back to the story. The earth did exactly as Moshe had said. It opened up, her mouth swallowed them up, their households, all the men, everything that they had, their families, their tents, all their goods, you name it, down into the pit they went. They went alive, the earth closed over them, and they perished from among the Kahal. And all Israel that were around them fled at the cry of them and said, "Whoa, no, this looks nasty, lest the earth swallow us up too." And it's a good thing that they got separated far enough that had they been any closer, they very well might have. Fire then came forth from Yahuwah, okay, the 250 other folks that were there, fire came forth and devoured them, those that offered incense. And if that sounds a little bit like the sons of Aaron that offered strange fire, I think it's intended to. Okay, so at this point, Yahuwah speaks to Moshe, and here's where I think we're going to see another element of the puzzle. "Speak to Eleazar, son of Aaron the priest, and say, go out and get all those fire pans, those 250 dead dudes, the ones that are out there still smoking, and collect them up, because they have become set apart." Say what? See, this at least shows you, I think, the suggestion seems to be, and it's the creator of the universe that's making it, that the thing that they were doing has now sanctified, set apart those fire pans to the point where they're going to be used as to make beaten plates for a covering of the altar, because they have, he says, become set apart. They were offered before Yahuwah. No doubt about it. He says they were offered before Yahuwah. And this will be a sign unto the B'nai Israel. So these brazen fire pans, which they that had now been burnt alive had offered, they beat them out for a covering of the altar, to be a memorial unto the B'nai Israel, the children of Israel, so that no common man, that's the point here, who is not of the seed of Aaron, would draw near to burn incense before Yahuwah. He has made a separation. He has said, because this is his sovereign prerogative, here is the people that I want to come before me. Remember, there's no ADA among the Kohanim either. He says that somebody's got a defect, they're clove-footed, or they, you know, got something that makes them less than desirable to me. Their stones have been crushed. Nope. They can do other things, but they can't come and serve in that particular capacity. Not to draw near to burn incense before Yahuwah, so that they don't fare like Korah and his company, as Yahuwah said unto him by the hand of Moshe. So we have a number of things coming together to indicate, all right, Korah was clearly in some form of rebellion, he and the 250 people that were with him. It cost them their lives. They were made a kind of dramatic, as a matter of fact, deadly example there of them. But were they completely antithetical the way so many so-called leaders today are, where they don't even pretend to serve Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh? They hate him. They despise him. They serve the adversary, and they don't even hide that. So there's at least one difference. Here's another interesting point, and I think this is, let's just say it's a hallmark of human nature. The next morning, Kol Ha'edat. The congregation of Israel, all of them, murmured, oh, have we seen this before? They murmured against Moshe and against Aaron, and they said, "Yeah, you have killed the people of Yahuwah." Nowadays they'd say, "You've killed the people of the Lord. We don't know which Lord it is. You killed him anyway." So Moshe and Aaron, again, go before Yahuwah. They came to the tent of meeting, and they hear from Yah, who says, "You know, lift yourselves up, get out from among this congregation, that I might consume them in a moment." Wait a sec. It's like, I've had enough of these folks. Just separate yourselves. It's going to be over in a flash. Pun intended. So Moshe said to Aaron, "Take your fire pan, put fire off the altar there, lay some incense on it, and move, dude." And he does, right? He heads down into the congregation to make atonement for them. And while he is running through the congregation, putting himself standing between the living and the dead, 14,700 people died. besides those that had already died in the manner of Korah. And the plague was stayed. So Aaron literally ran into the crowd, took his fire pan, and cauterized, if you will, this plague. I can just picture people dropping like flies as this wave moved out there among them. So now we have an issue with leadership, right? How are we going to determine what's going on here? Yah is going to make this real clear. He says to Moshe, go to the children of Israel, speak to them, take rods, one from each of the 12 fathers' houses, and write every man's name upon his own rod. Oh, yeah, and get Aaron's rod too. Put upon that the name for the rod of Levi, one rod for each of the houses. Lay them up there in the tent of meeting before the testimony, place where I meet with you. And it'll come to pass, the one that I choose, and you know which one it's going to be, don't we? We've read the end of the story. That will be the rod that buds. And that way I will make to cease from before me the murmurings of the B'nai Israel, all this this whining that they keep coming up with against you. So Moshe did it. They got the 12 rods, put them in there. And the next morning, they go in and look. Behold, the rod of Aaron for the house of Levi not only had budded, but it put forth buds, and it had bloomed blossoms, and it even bore ripe olives. That's quite the miraculous overnight thing. And I guess the answer is, yeah, it's pretty clear at this point, isn't it? Every man got his own rod, looked at it. Yep, mine looks the same as it did before. So Yahuwah says to Moshe, take that rod of Aaron, put it back in there before the testimony to be kept as a token, yet another memorial against the rebellious children, so that there'll be an end to these murmurings against me, and, oh yeah, so that they die not. So we got a number of elements of this. Let's pause and think for a second here about some of the things that are associated with this rebellion itself. Because what we're going to see here in this Torah portion and in some of the readings that over the years people have said should go with it and so forth, it's almost like a little bit of double-mindedness. But the very choices themselves do, I think, give us some clues. First, for example, the Haftorah for this story comes from the book of 1 Samuel chapter 11. Now let's turn there just for a second. And this is also one of the stories that I've always thought was kind of interesting. It's a continuation, if you will, of what I call the democracy or the demonocracy set. We actually had the first one last week with the first recorded vote. And we see that the two guys who were on Yah's team, right? Joshua and Caleb. They lost. They lost that first recorded vote, 10-2. Bigger issue, of course, everyone that even participated by whining about it, and it says all of the congregation, literally everybody, they were all outside their tents whining. And everybody above the age of majority, everybody that was over the age of 20 that had been numbered, had their head lifted up during the counting, the census, every single one of them, their carcasses eventually died in the wilderness. And that all happened before the people eventually went into the land. So we have the first recorded vote, disaster for those that not only voted against Yah, but even those that supported the vote and participated by whining about it afterwards or saying, oh, we don't believe the creator of the universe. And I have suggested, and I will again, that literally every place where we see something that looks like democracy or demonocracy in the Bible, it does not work out well. Here is the second of those cases. The story actually starts about 1 Samuel chapter 8, and we know the story. Essentially, it's give us a king like all the other nations. Make us a judge. Give us a king to judge like all the other nations. The goyim is the word there. That didn't sit well with Samuel the prophet. So he went to Yahuwah, who said to Samuel, hey, listen to those folks, in all that they say to you. Okay, they have come to him, essentially, overwhelmingly, they're asking for a king. It's kind of like a voice vote. And he says, Yahuwah says, they haven't rejected you, they have rejected me, that I should not be king over them. And moreover, that's what they've been doing all along, up to this very day. They serve other gods. That's what they're doing to you now. So listen to them. Heed their voice. But do this. Warn them. Show them what this king is going to do. And then in verse 11, and this is the rest of chapter 8, we see Samuel says, okay, I'll do that. He goes and he tells the people, this is what the behavior of the king who's going to reign over you is going to be. And by and large, it's not going to be so great. You're going to cry out eventually because of the king you have chosen. And Yahuwah won't listen to you in that day. All right, so the Haftorah portion for this week comes from a couple chapters later. It's chapter 11, and it goes into chapter 12, and that's where the rubber really meets the road, if you will. And this is the place where Samuel says to all the folks, okay, look, indeed, I heeded you, I listened to your voice, and you got a king. Here you go. Here is the king walking before you. Now, we know that this fella, his name is Saul. He was a good-looking, big, tall dude. And maybe that's about as much as you can say for him. But I am a witness today before you. And, you know, have I taken anything from you? Have I cheated any of you? Nope. Okay, so listen up. Here's the king which you've chosen. You asked for it. You got it. Toyota. Take note. Yahuwah has set a king over you. So here come the requirements. If you will fear Yahuwah and serve him and obey his voice and do not rebel against the commandment of the king. No, that's not what he says. Not of the king. The commandment of Yahuwah. Both you and the king who reigns over you. In other words, okay, there's a king. He had better listen to me. Isn't that interesting? What do we got today? A king who says, is there a polite way to say, screw you and the horse you rode in on to the creator of the universe? Because that's essentially what this entire world government is doing. We don't believe in a God of the Bible. You don't have any rights. You don't even have the right to own your own kids, take care of your own kids. We'll do what we want with them. We'll take you, and you'll like it. Or we'll just plain silence you first. That way we can kill you with impunity. Oh, yeah, we're going to take your guns, take your property, take everything that you had so that you won't be able to even so much as talk about it when we do to you whatever we blankety-blank and well want to you. There is law. Some of us are above the law. You ain't. You're below our boot. Jackboot, even. Okay, so back to Samuel. Here's the king you've chosen. You desired, okay, and if you will now fear Yahuwah and obey him and his voice, don't rebel against the commandment of, not the king, but of Yahuwah, both you and the king who reign over you, you continue to follow Yahuwah Yireh, that's great. On the other hand, if you do not obey the voice of Yahuwah, but rebel against the commandment of Yahuwah, then the hand of Yahuwah will be against you as it was against your fathers. Okay? And I'm going to do something here. Yahuwah is going to send thunder and rain so that you may perceive that your wickedness is great. And what you have done in the sight of Yahuwah in asking for a king for yourself is not exactly what he would have had happen. So Samuel called out to Yahuwah. Thunder and rain were sent by Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. All the people then greatly feared both Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh and the prophet Samuel. And they all said to him, to the prophet, pray for your servants to Yahuwah Yireh, your El, notice, not our El, that we may not die. There it is again. Because we've added to all of our other sins this one, the evil of asking for a king for ourselves. Okay, don't fear. You've done all this wickedness, yet don't turn aside from following Yahuwah. Just serve Yahuwah with all your heart. And don't go after empty things which cannot profit, because they're nothing. Yahuwah will not forsake his people for his great name's sake, because it pleased Yahuwah to make you his people. Okay? But just remember, if you do wickedly, you'll be swept away, both you and your king. So, again, the question, what about this idea of rebellion? Rebellion to who? Rebellion to what? How do we know? I think we have the advantage now that we were given another test from the Mashiach, the Torah made flesh. He said in his very first public address, look, how do you know? A good tree can't bring forth bad fruit, and a bad tree can't bring forth good fruit. By their fruit you will know them. Okay, we can look at the wicked fruit of San Francisco, Los Angeles, any of the places where the communists have taken over, where they're taking little kids and turning them into abominations before Yah. We can look at the entire world economy that's been turned. Folks, you can't look at the world today without going, what a stinking, fetid, satanic mess has been made of it. That's the fruit that we're seeing of this wickedness. And they don't even pretend. They don't even pay lip service anymore. They hate, they openly despise the God of the Bible. Is that the opposite of Moshe? I guess the answer I would say is, yeah, it wasn't Korah that was the true polar opposite of Moshe. Korah pretended, or at least he wanted the glory. He wanted certain things for himself. Obviously, he was full of hubris. he was too hot for his own shirt or whatever the song might have been. But we got people today that have a whole different problem. They hate the God of the Bible. They hate everything he stands for. They truly, openly serve the adversary, the wicked one. And, as yet another indicator, I've talked about this many times, if the Creator says, don't do this, this is an abomination before him, they not only do it, they subsidize it, they teach it to your children, they'll take your kids away from you if you don't teach it. They'll call you white supremacists and all kinds of bad names and call you an extremist if you simply admit that there just might be another God you'd rather serve than them. We're talking about a whole different level. So Korah wasn't a polar opposite. Korah, I will contend, was what we get at the opposite half cycle. He was a guy that thought he was serving Yah, but really wasn't. Whereas today what we have is an opposite in way, in deed, and in form that are not even pretending to serve the same God. They are serving true, utter wickedness. We know it. They know we know that they're doing that. Not the right God. Who are they serving, right? Is it the adversary? Again, we can see things clearly, at least at this point, are not exactly the same. I'll mention again this piece that I already came up with and trotted out there. This memorial that the people of Israel had, the fire pans from the dead guys that essentially served. They were beaten into the covering for the altar. There was a witness whenever they saw that. Whenever they thought about it, they recognized that. Aaron's rod that budded, that too was put in the place where it would be a testimony throughout generations. There's one more element of the story. Then we're going to talk about some of the other elements of the Haftorah and the Brit Hadashah reading for today. But the last chapter in the book here, chapter 18, says, Yahuwah says now to Aaron, okay, and here are some of the things that the Kohanim are going to do. You and your sons and your father's house and your brethren and all those who come after you. They're going to keep the charge. They're going to have charge of the tent. You know, we know what the assignments are going to be. And the common man, though, will not draw nigh unto you. I've taken the Levites from among the B'nai Israel, and they are given as a gift unto to Yahuwah to do the service of the tent of meeting. He has separated them. And throughout their generations, they're going to have a due, something that is theirs. And it has to do with those things that are taken from the altering, the offerings at the altar. I'll get it out. The chatat, the sin offerings, the olah, the things that are lifted up, so forth. These will be yours of the most holy things, reserved from the fire. Every offering of theirs, every meal offering, every sin offering, every guilt offering which they render under me. That is to be holy, set apart. It's for you and your sons. You eat them in a most holy place. Every male, eat these things. I have given them unto you, and ultimately some of the other elements of this to your sons, your daughters with you, as a due forever. Everyone that's clean in your house may eat of these things. The best of the oil, the best of the wine, the best of the corn. First part of all of those things, they have given them unto me, to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, and in turn I have given them to you. The first fruits of the land, the ripe things that are the first fruits, those two. Every devoted thing in Israel is yours. So what's interesting is we have this this rebellion. Out of the rebellion comes an idea that there is going to be a separation. The people that I choose, and that would be the Levites, and in particular the sons of Aaron and those that come through his generation, there are going to be things that are theirs and then things that are theirs alone, and there are going to be things that they need to do, a service that they will offer. They're mine. And as a result, they will bear certain iniquity, but they also have certain privileges that are associated with them. And I think as we go through some of the other elements of rebellion and what it is that Korah was after, he wanted the glory and so forth, there are some cautions here, there are some rewards, and I think that's what's kind of fascinating. I'll admit, some of this is a bit more subtle. And I think that's part of the reason why certain elements that we see in Scripture, over the years, I've taught some of these and talked about them, and I see people, and I've certainly done it myself, scratch our heads a lot of times. Okay, for example, here's an obvious one. We know that this is talked about in the book of Acts. Paul took a Nazirite vow, and I remember first time I read about the Nazirite vow thinking, well, what's the big deal? Why would somebody just want to, forego grapes, for example, and the fruit of the vine, and let your hair grow? What's the point of some of this? And essentially, the Midrash and the element that maybe it makes some sense. I think the more I look at it and the longer we are familiar with Scripture and more we read about it, the more we see things like this portion today, the more it kind of resonates with us. There is a difference between the Kohanim and the so-called common man. Common man can't go into those places that the Kohanim go. He doesn't do some of the things. But evidently, part of the idea of the Nazarite vow is so that he could at least get a taste of what it's like to be set apart, to be holy unto Yah. And unlike Korah, here is an outlet for how at least to get an understanding and a feel for that. And you may not be able to be a Kohen, but at least you can get a taste of it. So there's an element, I think, that has been provided for in that regard. There's also this, okay? This do forever. What is the thing that is set apart? It's the best of the wine, the best of the corn, the first fruits, a lot of the really good stuff, the food. Is this a high-profile position? Well, yeah, it's a high-profile position. Is it a high-prestige position? Well, I think arguably one could make the case that it is, but it's not, for example, like being a king or a potentate or a pope or certain things that we would say today, you know, carry the perks of high office and incredible riches and so forth, even the kind of things that, for example, Solomon had. So what is it? And as I was thinking about this, these words kind of fell to my lips. I say to you, they have their reward. Anybody remember that? Oh yeah, it's a comment that the Torah made flesh made, not once, not twice, but three times during his first public address, that Sermon on the Mount thing. And it has to do with doing good deeds and why. And I think the cautions in there really fit. They at least will help us to flesh out some of this idea of rebellion and who we serve and how we can recognize whether the rebellion to a fake God and those who serve him as opposed to a rebellion by a fake against the real God, even if it's supposedly for all the right reasons, I just want the glory for myself, this gives us a little bit more insight. So Yeshua puts it this way. This is chapter 6. Starting in the first verse, he says, "Take heed that you do not do your charitable deeds before men to be seen by them." Okay, we know where this is headed, right? We remember this. Don't let your right hand know what your left hand is doing. Better that you just make your offerings, do your nice good works, right? Your philanthropy. Not like the Bill Gateses of the world do so that they can, you know, vaccinate little children in Africa and sterilize them and do all kinds of other things and say, hey, look what a good dude I am. I'm killing billions for my God. There's a difference here. Therefore, when you do a charitable deed, says Yeshua, don't sound the trumpet like the hypocrites do. They're in the synagogues. In other words, don't get up on stage and say, look at me, I'm such a good dude. I give billions to the WHO and other organizations so that they might have glory from men. There it is. Don't do it so that you might have glory from men. What a great guy George Soros, Bill Gates. What wonderful people these Rothschilds are that they might have glory from men. Assuredly, I say to you, now here it is, here's the line, they have their reward. So this is the Torah made flesh saying, don't do it so you get glory from men. I'm telling you, that is their reward. That's all they're going to get. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. So here it comes. When you do a charitable deed, don't let your right hand know what your left hand know what your right hand is doing. Do your charitable deeds in secret. Now here comes the corollary. And he repeats this three times too. Do your charitable deed in secret so that your father in Hashemayim, who sees you in secret, will himself reward you openly. I have a suspicion, right? We know this. The way he rewards us isn't necessarily with likes on to Facebook or a massive riches showered down. Or whatever the case is. Okay, when you pray, don't be like the hypocrites. They like to pray to be seen. I say to you, you know, they're out there praying loudly so that everybody can see what great pious dudes they are. Assuredly, here it is. I say to you, they have their reward. Instead, he says, when you pray, enter into your room. When you've shut the door, then pray to your Father who is in the secret place. And he who sees you in secret will reward you openly. And here he says, don't do it with vain repetitions, and reminds us, here is one variant of the so-called Lord's Prayer. Our Father who art in heaven, Avinu Malkeinu, hallowed be your name, right? He gives the prayer. And then he says the following, moreover, okay, we're going to get one more repetition of this same reminder. Moreover, when you fast, don't do it the way the hypocrites do, with a sad countenance, so that everybody can say, oh, look at that guy, he's so hungry, he's been fasting, he's such a pious dude. Nope, don't do it that way. They disfigure their faces so that they can appear to men to be fasting. Oh, I need a little bit of makeup here. Oh, make me look like I haven't eaten for days. Assuredly, I say to you, they do this so that they can appear to men to be fasting. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. What's their reward? Oh, yeah, the approval of men. Posturing? We heard the terms, right? On social media, virtue signaling. This is not new, folks. It's old. Virtue signaling, it's just now that we have modern techniques of doing it on to Facebook, which has turned virtue signaling and having their reward with likes and other kind of things into a whole different class, a category. And what's it being used for? It's being used for control of people who have their reward and do it to be seen by men. And they do it for their likes, and they do it for the exposure. When you fast, he says, instead anoint your head and wash your face so that you don't even appear to be fasting. But your Father who is in the secret place knows, and he who sees you in secret will reward you openly. So the element, I guess, that I want to point out about this is that there is this common thread that seems to underlie it. Korah, what's he looking for? He claims he wants to serve God. That's not what he really wants. He wants to be seen serving God. He wants the acclamation of men. He and those 250 other guys, we want to be the head honcho. You take too much upon yourself. You know, hey, we are the ones that are going to really bring in the milk and the honey here. We're misappropriating that which is his unto ourselves. Is it the opposite of Moses? No. It's a different motivation, allegedly the same goal, but it's really not. And it was, in fact, a rebellion. And interestingly, it was a rebellion that cost them their lives, and it did so in dramatic fashion. You know, it was to the point where Moshe said, hey, you're going to see this new thing here, at least almost new thing. The earth will open up her mouth and show that this is not pleasing to Yah. And indeed it did. Then we have the do of the Kohanim. I can't help but think that one of the elements that has both resulted in a lot of perversion of the things of the Creator, This desire of men to be seen by men. Look at the history of the popes and some of the priesthoods in not just the Roman Church, but all kinds of others. Got the fancy robes, got the fancy buildings. Oh, we are the hottest stuff on the planet. Look at our fine clothing. Look at the great stuff we get to eat. You know, and hey, we may say that we're going to be celibate, but behind the scenes, we got all the little boys and the little girls, and you know what that we can handle and more. You know, we got appetites and. What has the Creator done? He has set up and said, no, my people are going to be separated. They will serve me. They will have their reward. It will be their due. And it'll be that which I specify, not which they want. This acclamation of men, oh yeah, that's a different deal. They have their reward. The things that are being done for the Father are done in secret. You do it, he will see you in secret, and you'll be rewarded openly, but it's not necessarily with the opulence and with the things that people think that they're seeing. Now, I guess from here, I got to go to the other place. Now, I'll admit, when I saw the Torah reading and the Haftorah reading and the Brit Hadashah reading, my first reaction was, oh, you know, been there, done that. A lot of you know that it's probably one of my least favorite verses in the twisted scriptures, the government-inspired version. But anyway, the Brit Hadashah reading, say some of those who've set the readings up, and that's about all I'll say about it, comes from Romans chapter 13. You know what it is, right? Let every soul be subject to the higher powers, the governing authority, because there is no authority except from God. and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. So if you resist the authority of God, you're going to go to hell. You'll bring judgment. Those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. So yes, Korah resisted. He brought judgment on himself. When Big Brother, the authority that exists, when Adolf says jump, when the Biden Fuhrer says jump, when Joe Stalin says jump, you say how high? Because good little slaves don't disobey their masters. Is that what it's saying? Okay, I've gone through the idea here of even the Greek words exousia. That is not necessarily the word that would have been used in Paul's writing. If he was speaking Hebrew or Aramaic as a native speaker, yes, and maybe he wrote this in Greek, or maybe he just wrote it in his head. And we don't know exactly. We don't have the original. At least I don't believe we have the original. But the point is, if it is in opposition to Torah, then it's wrong, and he wouldn't do that. So the question is, how do we understand this in accord with the Torah, and what does it mean here when it says governing authorities? Let every soul be subject to, and I like it this way, the one way to render that word, that Greek word here, is higher liberty. Let every soul be subject to the higher liberties. For there is no liberty, same word in the Greek, except from Elohim. And the liberties that exist are appointed by Elohim. Now, wait a second. Boy, that has a whole different spin to it, doesn't it? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created and equal and endowed by their Creator with certain higher liberties, that among these are life, liberty, and property, the pursuit of happiness, and that to secure these liberties, these rights, these higher things that come from Him, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Well, not only is that consistent with American history and law, and the things that the founders fought, pledged their sacred honors, and literally died for, it's also consistent with Scripture. These higher liberties, these things that come from Him, are from Him. Those whom He has made free are free indeed. Proclaim liberty throughout the land, right? There are lots of words that we can remember that were written there in the book that don't say essentially what we've been told Romans 13, government-inspired version, says. When Big Brother says jump, you say how high, you good little slave, you. Whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God, and those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. I'm picturing Emperor Palpatine, right? Whoever resists the liberty... What liberty? The liberty that the Creator has given us to choose. I have laid before you this day life and blessing, death and cursing, so choose life. You resist that. You're resisting the ordinance, the higher liberty of Elohim. Those who resist bring judgment on themselves. In other words, folks, there is a right way and a wrong way to look at this. The wrong way basically says the way tyranny wants it to be interpreted, the way those who hate the God of the Bible will tell you that's what He really meant. In other words, I hate the God of the Bible. You love the God of the Bible. That means you better walk in obedience to me who hate Him. Can we see any inconsistency in that? Is it just possible there's something wrong here? What was it that we saw with Saul? Hey, you've asked for this king. As long as he obeys the God of the Bible, okay, then you better walk in obedience. If he doesn't, he's got a problem. You got a problem. But you asked for this king. Now, some of us would say, wait a minute, we didn't ask for this king. Whether you believe that the election was rigged or just all fake as all get out, did you sign up for a Dominion voting machine and tens of millions of fake ballots and a king, somebody that usurps authority? Remember when the king was supposed to be bound, what was it Jefferson said? Bind them down by the chains of the Constitution. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. All kinds of things, in other words, that we just don't care about anymore. Isn't it funny? None of that seems to apply anymore. The rest of Romans 13, by the way, let's just read another verse or two, even as twisted, and we'll make sure we kind of see what's consistent and what's not consistent. But it says here, for rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Rulers, good, in other words, rulers that are the kind that we're talking about with Saul and Samuel, are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Is that another way of saying that the creator of the universe does not put evil rulers in place? Well, I guess he could put them in place as a judgment against people who are rebelling against him anyway. I'm not going to argue that that hasn't happened and isn't indeed now happening in the world, especially in the United States. You know, even Ben Franklin said, you know, this government will likely be ruled well for a while, but eventually it will fall into despotism at such point as the people basically aren't fit for anything except being governed by tyrants and despots. And here we are. So I don't necessarily see an inconsistency in that. But what Scripture is saying here, if we read this correctly, real rulers, the kind that come from him, are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Do you want to be unafraid of the real authority? Well, do what is good. You will have praise from the same. Listen to that and ask yourself the question, is that true? If you today say, for example, I want to raise my children in obedience to the God of the Bible, I want them to be God-fearing. I want them to know that there is such a thing as men and women and male and female he created them. And Big Brother will reward me for doing that. Merrick Garland, when I go down to the school board meeting, will say, oh, how could we possibly have wanted your little children to be turned into something which is antithetical to God? Of course, good rulers are not a terror to good works. Oh, thank you, soccer mom, for coming in here and setting us straight. By the way, Big Brother will haul you away to the gulag on your way out the door. We're taking your kids, too. They're going to go to California. We'll cut off their little penises before they know what they're for. Does anybody believe that the rulers today that are doing this evil, this utter wickedness, that are pushing abominations before the Creator and deserving of that millstone, as Yod-Heh Vav-Heh and the Torah made flesh put it, that they are doing anything that's even remotely a terror except to those who try to serve Yod-Heh Vav-Heh and Him alone? How far have we come? Again, we're at the point, folks, where I don't think it's even possible. I don't even think it's remotely possible for an honest person to look at what is going on in the United States of terror, in the cesspools, in the halls of Congress. I've got the stories here. I was debating whether or not to read any of these or not. Here's one quick one. McCarthy warns the House. This is in the same week that the Biden-Fuhrer and the crackhead son have been caught. They've got the messaging where they basically were stiffing a communist Chinese briber, saying, "Hey, you better pay up, okay? Because we keep a grudge and we know where you live and we can take care of it." This is the same guy that said, my son Hunter, he's a good boy, and I don't know anything about his business, except for, you know, whenever I need to put the strong arm to somebody, I do it. So what does McCarthy say? Well, now is not the time to force a vote on impeachment. Why? There's no time to force impeachment. We got a nuclear war to get prosecuted here. Hell, we got a guy that wants to kill some more kids. You look at this and you go, what's it going to take? The answer is, it's not like it's going to take anything, folks. They aren't hiding it. This is truly a level of evil that is demonstrated that the rule of law just doesn't apply anymore. There are those that are above the law. One law, one Torah for you and the stranger that dwells among you. No, we have no pretense of that anymore. So what does that mean? Let every soul be subject to the higher liberties, for there is no liberty except from Elohim, and the liberties that exist are appointed by Elohim. So who do we serve? Rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God. It's not Scripture, but it was certainly cited by some people who knew a lot about it and who put their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor on the line as well. Where are we? At what point in time? I guess I would suggest that it's real clear. You know, the rebellion of Korah had to do with self-serving. Had to do with a guy saying, we want to serve the same God. We just want the glory for it. Okay, so the Creator ended up putting things in place, memorials, to show what happens to that kind of people. And then to say, look, here are the dues. Here are the things that are going to be for those who truly serve me, the Kohanim. Yeshua warned against those that are looking for the glory of men. They have their reward. It's about the things that the Creator gives you and says, here, this is your due. This is from me. So in all of these things, I think the common thread seems to be, he is saying, those that are mine, those that will walk in obedience to me, those that I have chosen, They will do my work. I will reward them. They do not seek glory from men. It's not about looking for glory from men. It's about doing the work, and they will have their reward too. They'll have their reward from me. Even if it's done in secret and they don't get the likes on to Facebook, or they don't get the acclamation of those people saying, oh, you are the Bidenfuhrer. You know, you can fill a high school broom closet with your admirers. Those that believe you won the election. Okay, there's still times and places where we can say, we can still recognize truth from lies, folks. We're at a place where we have to be able to do that. We have to be able to say, okay, who do we serve? There's another line from Joshua. It appears a number of places in the book. There was this time, right, where every man did what was right in his own eyes. And I've always thought that was an interesting turn of phrase. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. It certainly can be perceived and should be, in a lot of cases, as negative. Because we got people that say, oh, what's right in my own eyes is to cut genitalia off little boys and girls. Groom them for what I want to do to them. Take away their mommies and daddies and replace them with the almighty state. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. Well, you know what? It's also true that those who read the Torah and understand that we pray for, and hopefully we are given eyes to see and ears to hear, and we walk in obedience to the Creator, well, if what we are doing in fact is right in our own eyes because it's right in His eyes, there's not a problem. If He gives us eyes to see and ears to hear. The question is, are we walking in obedience? How do we know? He has given us His Word. He has given us not only His Word, He's given us examples for good and for ill, like Korah, like Moshe. He's given us the example of the Messiah. He has given us the signs, the fire pans of those who died, making the point. He gave us Aaron's rod that budded. He's given us many, many other signs, 3 days and three nights in the grave, just like the sign of Jonah and the great fish. It's not like we don't have lots and lots of indicators. In particular, I think it's always educational to go back and say, hey, how about the signs of that first time, and what was it that got those people in so much trouble? Why is it that during that first recorded vote, right, they sided against Joshua and Caleb? They went with the 10-2 vote, said, hey, our side won this first Democratic vote. And their carcasses all fell right there in the wilderness. Because they had seen. They knew or should have known is the terminology you'd see in if we still had courts of law. They knew or should have known because they had seen it with their own eyes, that there is a Creator, that He has said, here are the things that I want you to do. You guys were there. You heard the thunderings. You saw the tablets that Moshe brought down. You saw the miracle. You went through the Red Sea. You're without excuse. And I guess you could say then they had their reward. Now, as for the rest of us, what do we have? Honestly, I've never seen the fire pans. I haven't seen the altar. Haven't seen the tablets of the testimony. Haven't even seen the Ark of the Covenant. But we know those things exist. Well, at least they did exist. Are they still somewhere, you know, buried out there with Indiana Jones? Don't know. Does it matter or not? Well, we have a record. We have a written record. Matter of fact, we have a written record that is so consistent that if we actually will study it, we'll see that it is more consistent than could possibly be even put in place by anything other than the divine hand of the author and creator. So, to my mind, that's one of the things that really speaks to me. As much as if I had seen the Red Sea parted, I can read the miracles, I can read the consistency of Scripture, I can see the elements in His Word and go, hey, this is the hand, this is the Word of the one true living God. The pieces here, right, from Genesis to maps, they're so consistent that they tell the story. They tell me who the real Creator is, they tell me who my Master is. They tell me who, as he wrote about it, Paul's Master is, Kepha's Master is. They were all bondservants of the Most High. Just like we should be. They have the reward. Let us do these things in secret. The reward that He has for us is the one that we should be looking for. Right? The thing that I hope, my prayer, more than anything else, is to hear the words, well done, thou good and faithful servant. There's a reward, folks, that we can all honestly, prayerfully aspire to. So on all of these subjects and all of these cases, I guess, on the one hand, it seems kind of subtle, right? What are the differences? I started by asking, what's the opposite of Moses? Is it the opposite half cycle, or is it a polar opposite? Korah was kind of an opposite. He was certainly in opposition to Moses then, right? That's one way to look at an opposite. But he at least thought he served the same God. He just served him for different reasons, wanted different things. What do we got today? We have polar opposites. We have so-called leaders that literally, without question, I don't think there's any honest way to argue that, fill in the blanks, FBI, CIA, IRS, ATF, any of these people that are serving this fake God, this government which is antithetical to everything, that all those people who gave the last full measure of devotion, their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honors to serve a nation dedicated to this idea that there is a God and that our rights come from Him and that the purpose of government is to secure these rights, there is no common ground here. What has happened is so antithetical to those, we can't even pretend not to see it anymore. So where does that leave us? Well, I'm not going to advocate rebellion. Now, I will tell you, just like John Hancock did, that when they put their signatures on a document that said, we know the king is a tyrant, and we're going to urge a peaceful separation, they knew what was going to happen. We know, too. We don't necessarily know how it's going to play out, but we know that Hasatan, the adversary, he does not give up power willfully, voluntarily. He does not like the idea that we have a choice. I've laid before you life and blessing, death and cursing. Choose life. He didn't want us to have a choice. He wants us to be coerced. He wants to take the children by force. He wants to take people by force, take their weapons by force, take their God away from them, take their scriptures away from them by force. And he will brook no opposition. And that makes him very, very different from the creator of the universe that says, you have a choice. There are consequences to your choice. I'm telling you what they are. But you still have that choice. So I'll end as I often do, and that's just by suggesting that, we're in a place where what we say may not matter. Because any opposition to the prince of this world, to the satanic host that believes they run this planet, and arguably it was by abdication from those who should have known better, but they're not going to brook any opposition. On the other hand, we know we're supposed to serve Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh and Him alone. We've been warned, man can't serve two masters. You'll love one, you'll hate the other. So choose. Folks, we have to choose. They can call it what they want. But what really matters is, even if there isn't a Moses out there today, even if we don't have a someone who is anointed and speaks directly with Yah to the point where he will call down these things. And by the way, call down fire from heaven. Yeah, I'm picturing that line from Revelation. We know the bad guys are going to be able to do at least imitations of that, just like they did during the time of Moses as well. They're going to imitate some of the things that look like power. The two witnesses will call down fire from heaven. I'm looking forward to seeing that. That'll be fun. That'll be interesting. That'll certainly be educational. That'll be another sign of the times. But in the meanwhile, we got to be overcomers. We have to do what He tells us to do. Understand that what they call you isn't important. Oh, you're a white supremacist. You're an extremist. You're a domestic violent extremist, a terrorist. Okay, so you can read the Constitution, so you serve the God of the Bible. By definition, so far as they're concerned, that makes you a terrorist. You know what? I could care less. What I care about is one thing. Hearing the words, well done, thou good and faithful servant. Walking in obedience to Him and to Him alone. It's going to get tough. But it's not that hard. He tells us we will not be tested beyond what we can endure. So as for where we are today and what we know and what we can learn from Korah and from the founding fathers who rebelled against tyranny then, and what we are going to have to rebel against, or at least be called rebels for rebelling against. Why? Because we serve Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh and Him alone. It really isn't that hard. choose this day whom you will serve. As for me and my house, we will serve Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh and him alone. How do we know? This is something else that I have spent a lot of time talking about of late, right? He wrote the book for us. He says, do a whole lot of things that the whore church is going to tell you you don't have to do anymore. If you love me, keep my commandments. Which commandments? All of them. Ones I wrote down for you. Keep my Sabbaths. Keep my Moedim. Now, you can't do exactly everything. Don't get hung up on that score. You can't offer offerings in a temple that doesn't exist and a place where my name is now being dissed as opposed to worshipped, where nothing that I said to do is being done. Now, you can't do that. Don't sweat it. But you can memorialize them. You can do your best to not work, whatever that means, on the Sabbath. You can bring up your children in the way that they should be. You can speak the truth bold. There's a lot of things, in other words, that he has told us that we can do and should do. There are certain things, because we're not Kohanim, we're not kings, we're not women if we're men or vice versa. And no, we don't put on those things and try to pretend otherwise because that's an abomination. Still, though, we can do those things. We can walk in obedience as best we can. The reward that we want, the reward that we should be seeking after, is the one that comes from obedience to him. Doesn't have to be shouted from the rooftops or receive lots of likes on to Facebook or a great social justice score from the Biden-Fuhrer's regime. What it requires, folks, is just understanding. Study to show yourself approved. Come out and be separate. And yes, there are certainly a lot of practical things. I think we're going to see more and more of those to be aware of. In order to survive physically, we're going to have to separate ourselves. We're going to have to put together those parallel economies. That's a word I've heard a lot in the last month or two. Hell, I've been talking about parallel economies for 20 years. Silver, kasef, honest weights and measures. Things that the Constitution has given us, we still have pre-1964 coinage, for just one example. Honest weights and measures, lawful tender. We can do all of those things. Always have been able to. Need to. Had better be able to understand and start doing it now, because we're going to have to build those, not so much parallel economies, as just places where we walk in obedience to the Creator. And trust that he'll guide us and that he'll bring us together in that. Let's close in prayer. Yahuwah Eloheinu, Yahuwah Echad. Father, we come before you. We thank you for your word. We thank you that for now we can still gather together. We can pray together. Let iron sharpen iron. We do then ask that you'd give us eyes to see and ears to hear, that you would help us to rightly divide your word of truth. Show us how we should walk. Help us to hear, to listen, to understand, to walk in obedience to the still small voice. We pray, Abba, that you would guide us in this time to come. We know that there will be deception. It literally, lawlessness abounds, and we're seeing it. So help us to come out. Help us to be separate. Help us to recognize those things that are not of you, and to simply say, we will not participate in them. Guide us so that as we come in a not just spiritual or economic sense, but a physical sense, that we separate ourselves, come out, that you would guide us, bring us together again, help us to build the places where we can build the kind of communities that are in accord with your word, that are a blessing to one another. Guide us in this time ahead, Abba. Help us to be counted worthy to escape these things that are coming. Help us to be found doing your work from now through all that lies ahead until and through the time of your return. And Father, all of this we ask in your set-apart name, for you are our King, our Savior, our Redeemer, our Mashiach, our help in times of trouble. You are Yahuwah Zedeknu, Yahuwah Vitzivenu, Yahuwah Zevuot. You are our banner, Yahuwah Nisi, our healer, Yahuwah Rapha, our all-sufficient El Shaddai, and we thank you and praise you. Hallelujah. Amen. Let's close the live portion with the Aaronic blessing. We remember that Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, saying, "Speak in turn to Aaron and his sons, and say to them, this is how you bless the B'nai Israel. Say to them, Yivarekecha Yahuwah v'arishmarecha, Yair Yahuwah panavalecha v'chunecha, Isayahuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuhuh Shalom. May Yahuwah bless you and keep you. May Yahuwah make his face to shine upon you. May Yahuwah lift his countenance upon you and give you his shalom. Amen. And thus he said, they shall put Shemi, my name, on the B'nai Yisrael, and I myself shall bless them.